Continuing once again with Scott's quotation from the Pentagon Papers. No new programs were proposed or endorsed. No increases in the level or nature of U.S. assistance suggested or foreseen. The emphasis was on persuading the new government in Saigon to do well those things which the fallen government was considered to have done poorly. NSAM 273 had, as described above, limited cross-border operations to an area 50 kilometers within Laos. Scott goes on to comment here. The reader is invited to check the veracity of this account of NSAM 273 against the text, as reconstructed from various sources in our Appendix A. If the author of this study is not a deliberate and foolish liar, then some superior had denied him access to the second and more important page of NSAM 273, which authorized planning for specific covert operations graduated in intensity against the DRV, unquote, i.e., North Vietnam. As we have seen, this covert operations planning soon set the stage for a new kind of war, not only through the celebrated 34A operations, which contributed to the Tonkin Gulf incidents, but also through the military's accompanying observations as early as December of 63 that only air attacks against North Vietnam would achieve these operations' stated objectives, unquote. And next, Scott goes on to refer to a man named Leslie Gelb, who is the author of the Pentagon studies, which have become known as the Pentagon Papers. Leslie Gelb is also the national security editor of the New York Times. Continuing here, Scott writes, Leslie Gelb, the director of the Pentagon Study Task Force and the author of the various and mutually contradictory study summaries, notes that with this planning, quote, a firebreak had been crossed, and the U.S. had embarked on a program that was recognized as holding little promise of achieving its stated objectives, at least in its early stages. We have argued that these crucial and controversial stated objectives proposed in SINCPAC's O-Plan 3463 of September 9th of 1963 were rejected by Kennedy in October of 1963 and first authorized by the first paragraph of National Security Action Memorandum 273. And Scott goes on here to describe the manner in which the Pentagon Papers deceive with regard to the Kennedy announcement of troop withdrawal on November 20th. We read part of this passage last week, but I think it's worth repeating. The Pentagon studies, supposedly disinterested reports to the Secretary of Defense, systematically mislead with respect to NSAM 273, which McNamara himself had helped to draft. Their lack of bona fides is illustrated by the general phenomenon that, as can be seen from our Appendix A, banal or misleading paragraphs like 2, 3, and 5 are quoted verbatim, sometimes over and over, whereas those preparing for an expanded war are either omitted or else referred to obliquely. The only study to quote a part of the paragraph dealing with North Vietnam does so from subordinate instructions. It fails to note that this language was authorized in NSAM 273. And study after study suggests, as did press reports at the time, that the effect of NSAM 273 paragraph 2 was to perpetuate what Mr. Gelb ill-advisedly calls the public White House promise in October, unquote, to withdraw 1,000 U.S. troops. In fact, the public White House statement on October 2nd was no promise, but a personal estimate attributed to McNamara and Taylor. As we have seen, Kennedy's decision on October 5th to implement this withdrawal, a plan authorized by NSAM 263 of October 11th, was not made public until the Honolulu Conference of November 20th, when an accelerated withdrawal program, about which Mr. Gelb is silent, was also approved. NSAM 273 was in fact approved on Sunday, November 24th, and its misleading opening paragraphs, including the meaningless reaffirmation of the objectives of the October 2nd withdrawal statement, were leaked to selected correspondents. Mr. Gelb, who should know better, pretends that NSAM 273 was intended primarily to endorse the policies pursued by President Kennedy and to ratify provisional decisions reached on November 20th in Honolulu, unquote. In fact, the secret effect of NSAM 273's sixth paragraph, which unlike the second was not leaked to the press, was to annul the NSAM 263 withdrawal decision announced 4 days earlier at Honolulu and also the accelerated withdrawal program. Both military and economic programs, it was emphasized, should be maintained at levels as high as those in the time of the Diem regime, unquote. The source of this change is not hard to pinpoint. Of the 8 people known to have participated in the November 24th reversal of the November 20th withdrawal decisions, 5 took part in both meetings. Of the 3 new officials present, The chief was Lyndon Johnson in his second full day and first business meeting as President of the United States. The importance of this second meeting, like that of the document it approved, is indicated by its deviousness. One can only conclude that NSAM 273 paragraph 2's public reaffirmation of an October 2nd withdrawal objective, unquote, coupled with 273 paragraph 6's secret annulment of an October 5th withdrawal plan, was deliberately deceitful. The result of the misrepresentations in the Pentagon studies and Mr. Gelb's summaries is, in other words, to perpetuate a deception dating back to NSAM 273 itself.
Basically, just boiling the whole thing down, although I think that Mr. Scott and Dave in his reading went over it pretty carefully, just to boil things down for you nicely, basically what we're looking at is a planned effort, and quite an effort it took also, and if you want to call it conspiracy, you can, but I think the facts show that whatever you call it, it was definite and deliberate, an attempt on the part of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and President Johnson and others to literally reverse the course of the Kennedy administration under the guise of continuing the Kennedy administration's response to Vietnam. I'm going to read one last thing here. This is from the same essay, from Peter Dale Scott's essay from the Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond, the Kennedy Assassination and the Vietnam War is the name of the essay. And in this particular anthology, this is Mr. Scott's summing up paragraph, and it goes as follows. National Security Action Memorandum 273, it seems clear, was an important document in the history of the 1964 escalations, as well as in the reversal of President Kennedy's late and ill-fated program of Vietnamization by 1965. The systematic censorship and distortion of NSAM 273 in 1963 and again in 1971 by the Pentagon study and later by the New York Times raises serious questions about the bona fides of the Pentagon study. It also suggests that the Kennedy assassination was itself an important, perhaps a crucial, event in the history of the Indochina War. I'm going to be getting on into the essentially the second part of the show, and this in fact ties in, though, to some things mentioned in the first part of the show. One of the key points at which it ties in, and it also ties into the first show, in which we discussed the growing rift between the Kennedy presidency, well, actually dating back to the Eisenhower presidency, between the presidency and the performance of the secret intelligence networks, namely the CIA, the FBI, later on the DEA, the DIA, things of that nature. But specifically in this instance, we're going to be talking about, among other things, about some involvement by certain people and their connections to the CIA. And, of course, we're going to be linking this to Watergate because, as everybody knows who's read their Watergate primer, the CIA was a key participant in the Watergate affair. Now, that's not saying what they did or what they were responsible for, but at the very least, they were a key participant in the Watergate affair.
Okay, now, Watergate basically was a break-in in which a number of people connected, well, actually working for the Committee to Re-elect President Nixon were caught burglarizing the Democratic National Headquarters in the Watergate complex. Now, this plumber's unit was put together by President Nixon in response to Daniel Ellsberg's leaking of the Pentagon Papers, okay? Now, we were just talking about the Kennedy assassination and the Vietnam War. Well, that basically dealt with Peter Dale Scott's comparison of the National Security Action Memoranda from which the Pentagon Papers were compiled with the Pentagon Papers and the summary studies themselves. And when this was released to the press, the Pentagon Papers, that is, was released to the press. Keep in mind it was a Pentagon history. When that was released to the press, it said it so upset President Nixon that he put together this plumber's unit to investigate national security leaks, and that's how that whole thing got started.
Okay, now, again, we realize this is complicated stuff. Here's a couple of high points to bear in mind as to what we're talking about. There was a growing rift, as I mentioned before, between the intelligence networks and the presidency. Well, specifically the Kennedy presidency and the liberal presidency. Now, also, and a key point to realize to be involved in here, now, Richard Nixon will crop up a couple of times during this show. Now, we're not accusing Richard Nixon of anything per se. However, of course, Richard Nixon is the central figure in the Watergate affair. You will remember Richard Nixon also came up when we were talking about the early breaks between the CIA and the presidency, the Kennedy presidency, in the Bay of Pigs, because Nixon had been, as Eisenhower's vice president, the chief action officer for the Bay of Pigs, and he had planned, along with the CIA and members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Bay of Pigs operation. He was the one who essentially put it on the tracks, which did not come to fruition until the Kennedy presidency began.
And worth noting in that particular context that he put this thing together with the U.S. intelligence apparatus, at least a good portion of it, in direct defiance of presidential orders, because President Eisenhower had directed that no action be taken against Cuba, so that no set policy, so that the succeeding administration would not inherit a predefined policy. And President Kennedy, then, even as a candidate, had penetrated this insider's cabal, as a researcher who we referred to on the subject called it, and had interviewed some of these people that were putting this operation together against presidential authority and independent of any constitutional authority. So keep this in mind. Eisenhower did not sanction it. Kennedy did not sanction it. And it later turned out that the CIA, apparently, or elements thereof, deep-sixed its own operation.
Okay, and one more key thing to remember about Richard Nixon is that at the time when the Bay of Pigs was being planned and other things that we still probably have not found out about and some we have found out about, it was the common apprehension, the common concept that Richard Nixon, as vice president of a fairly successful Republican administration, would indeed succeed Dwight Eisenhower as president of the United States. So that has to be borne in mind also. The Kennedy victory, which was very close, was regarded by many, especially in the right-wing establishment, the military establishment, and the intelligence establishment, as being essentially a kind of a counter-revolution, a real coup against their support for the Nixon presidency and the continuation of business as usual in the clandestine sector. Now, going back to the high points again, we have a rift, we have a schism growing between the presidency and the intelligence networks. We have Richard Nixon with heavy involvement with the intelligence networks in and out of office. Also, we have a very key thing going on here where the CIA has always, and this was not just starting then, but the CIA and other intelligence operations have always been very much involved in deniability. So there's a key factor here. A lot of times during the Kennedy assassination, say, during the Warren investigation, the CIA, under questioning from the Warren Commission, would say, well, Lee Harvey Oswald has never been on our payroll. Well, anybody who knows anything about intelligence knows that you don't put people on your payroll if you want to be able to deny them. We see this coming up in a number of other situations where quote-unquote ex-CIA agents or people with affiliations to the CIA but no formal title keep showing up again and again performing CIA business. So that's another thing to keep bear in mind. Do not be fooled by the simplistic logic of, well, the CIA says they're not on the payroll, so they're not CIA agents. Okay?
It's worth noting in this regard, too, that the head of the Plumbers Unit, who was James McCord, immediately prior to going to work for the committee to reelect the president, he was an active duty CIA officer, and his duties included his main responsibility. He was in charge of physical security for CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia.
That's right, and he was another person whom one would just wonder why at age, 45 or 46 or so, this man in the prime of his career, coming off an extremely hot position as security chief for the CIA, would suddenly retire. This is the kind of thing, we're not going to get into McCord too much right now, this is the kind of thing we're talking about, because we're seeing this everywhere, and we have been for 35 years.
And keep in mind Nixon's role in planning the Bay of Pigs, independent of Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy, and keep in mind that all of the, virtually all, there may have been some members of the Plumbers Unit who were not Bay of Pigs veterans, but all of the people arrested in the Watergate complex itself were Bay of Pigs veterans.
That's right. Part of the CIA's vast army of anti-Castro Cubans who had been hired and trained by the CIA and then later on ostensibly or supposedly laid off or fired by the CIA, which perhaps could have been the case or perhaps was merely another situation of the CIA establishing deniability.
A lot of this is complex. We've been over it before. Any questions, give us a call during the phone-in section.
That's
we'll clarify
right.
Any points.
Not a doubt. We've got some other stuff about Richard Nixon that we will mention later, too. Okay, I'm going to read a small segment here. This article originally appeared in Ramparts magazine, which we've mentioned before. However, it is the edition that we are reading from is also out of the anthology we've been using tonight, The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. It appeared in Ramparts in 1973. This is also by Peter Dale Scott. And this is on his section in which he is talking about the Kennedy assassination and its relation to some rather interesting characters. And I'm going to read as follows. The Secret Service in Dallas intercepted a letter to Oswald postmarked Havana, November 28, 1963, That's 3 days, 6 days after the Kennedy assassination, and signed by Pedro Charles, Pedro, P-E-D-R-O, Charles. The letter indicated that, quote, Oswald had been paid by Charles to carry out an unidentified mission, which involved accurate shooting, unquote. Meanwhile, the FBI possessed a letter from Havana to Robert Kennedy, quote, written by one Mario del Rosario Molina, which alleged that Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated President Kennedy at the direction of Pedro Charles, a Cuban agent. When they say Cuban in this case, the letters alleged that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting on behalf of the Castro government. That's the Cuban agent that they're referring to Pedro Charles as supposedly being. Anyway, continuing on with the Warren Commission's assessment. According to the writer, Oswald met with Pedro Charles in Miami, Florida several months ago, in other words, in early 1963, and was paid $7,000 by Charles. That's quoted directly from the Warren Commission testimonies. By now, and this is going back to Scott's article, by now this story seems absurd. The elaborate FBI chronology of Oswald's movements gave no indication that he ever visited Miami. Okay, and let me mention one other thing, too, real briefly. This is right out of the Warren Commission, although it's not mentioned in this particular article, is that the FBI also discovered that those two letters, one of them alleging that a letter to Oswald signed by Pedro Charles, blah, 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 saying Oswald was going to have to do some accurate shooting, and the one to Robert Kennedy revealing this connection, were both written on the same typewriter. So you can see what kind of story this was. It was an obviously planted story. Now, going on with Mr. Scott's article. But at the time the letters arrived, a reporter in the Miami area named James Buchanan was publishing stories attributed to Frank Sturgis, alias Frank Fiorini. Frank Sturgis, of course, Watergate burglar, Watergate involvement, ex-CIA, ex-Bay of Pigs veteran.
Also, by the way, in charge of managing the mob's casinos during the mafia heyday in pre-Castro Cuba.
Indeed. All right. James Buchanan, this Miami reporter, was publishing stories attributed to Frank Sturgis that Oswald had been in Miami and also had been in contact with Castro's Cuban intelligence. Later reports from James Buchanan's brother, Jerry, placed Oswald in Miami in March of 1963. These concatenating pieces of misinformation from Miami and Havana suggest, in retrospect, a conspiracy to mislead. And again, the knowledge that both of the letters were written on the same typewriter also certainly leads to that possible conspiracy. The stories today are much less important than Buchanan's sources for them, all of whom came from two Miami-based anti-Castro groups. The first group, the DRE, the Student Revolutionary Directorate, was Cuban. And we're going to get back to that in a second when I finish the article. That's the DRE. We'll talk about that. The first group, the DRE, was Cuban, and the CIA used it to infiltrate Cuba in connection with the Bay of Pigs. The DRE was named in Oswald's notebook, since Oswald had been in contact with him in New Orleans and perhaps in Dallas. The second American group, which included both James Buchanan and his brother Jerry, was the International Anti-Communist Brigade. It was a small band of mercenaries headed by a named source of Buchanan's articles, Frank Sturgis, alias Fiorini, the future burglar of Watergate. Sturgis, like the DRE, had been employed by the CIA in connection with the Bay of Pigs invasion. But after the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, Kennedy had begun to crack down on anti-Castro raids launched from the continental United States. Jerry Buchanan had been arrested by the British in the Bahamas in April 1963 on board a boat formerly used in CIA missions and now being used without presidential authorization for an intended raid against a Soviet tanker. In September, the federal government had issued, quote, strong warnings to six Americans for their anti-Castro activities, including Frank Fiorini, or Frank Sturgis, same name, same person, and Alexander Rourke, the owner of Jerry Buchanan's boat. As for James Buchanan, the brigade's secretary and propaganda director, Sturgis allegedly broke with him in December 1963 because of his, quote, excessive attacks on the FBI and the CIA, quote, even going so far as to describe former President John F. Kennedy as a communist. Similar anti-Kennedy sentiments were allegedly expressed by Carlos Bringier, Oswald's contact with the DRE in New Orleans, and a right-winger who later headed up the Cuban Americans for Nixon Agnew. Another witness told the Warren Commission that Bringier, because, quote, the United States didn't help to overthrow Castro, hates the United States almost as much as he hates Russia, unquote. Because these sentiments were so widely held among Cuban exiles, many students of the Dallas assassination have theorized that a group of anti-Castro terrorists, Cuban and or American, may have killed Kennedy in revenge for having been abandoned by the CIA in 1963. Okay, now a couple of quick points to make. Carlos Bringier, who is the member of the DRE that they mentioned in connection with floating this phony story about Oswald and a supposed Castro intelligence agent named Pedro Charles. Well, those of you who listened to last week's show heard...
Two weeks ago.
My apologies. Heard Lee Harvey Oswald. You're right. You heard Lee Harvey Oswald on a radio program with Carlos Bringier on the program attempting to steer Lee Harvey Oswald into saying that he agreed with Fidel Castro's characterization of John F. Kennedy as a thief and a ruffian. Okay, and Bringier, a violently anti-Castro Cuban right-winger, was on this program with Lee Harvey Oswald, where he made his announcement of Marxism that was aired all over the country on the night of the assassination. Again, Bringier tried to steer Oswald into a position siding with Castro and calling Kennedy a thief and a ruffian. Now, go ahead.
Couple of points that now remember that this organization, the DRE, why don't you handle a Spanish on that, Nip?
Yes, it's the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil.
Okay, now that is a CIA-sponsored organization. Bringier is a member of that, and he is in this radio interview, which we aired a couple of weeks ago from radio station WDSU in New Orleans. And this was aired in August of 63 originally, and then, of course, everyone all over the country was able to hear Lee Harvey Oswald talk about what a communist he was the night of the assassination. Now, the person who was on there who helped arrange this, along with Jim Stuckey, the host, and, of course, Oswald was there, was a fellow by the name of Ed Butler. Now, Ed Butler was affiliated with an organization called the Information Council of the Americas, also a CIA-sponsored organization. So here we have a couple of people with documented CIA ties, interviewing Lee Harvey Oswald, talking about what a Castro sympathizer he was. Now, keep in mind about Oswald that he was the sole member of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Now, this pro-Castro, pro-communist organization shared an address. Basically, it was one of two addresses from which you could get to the same second-store walk-up, which was shared by an office which it masqueraded as a detective agency. In effect, it was a far right-wing paramilitary front, which we're going to talk about in just a second.
Involved in, among other things, shipping arms to Cuban anti-Castro activists, okay? So once again, to touch on the high points here, we have almost immediately after the assassination, we have a rather contrived and elaborate story being floated with letters coming from Havana, et cetera, suggesting that Lee Harvey Oswald was a Castro agent sent to kill Kennedy. And these stories are concocted, among others, by Frank Sturgis, who later turns up, who is a CIA Bay of Pigs veteran, et cetera, et cetera, later turns up as a Watergate burglar, and Carlos Bringier, who set Oswald up on national radio as a Marxist and later shows up heading the Nixon Agnew, Cuban Americans for Nixon Agnew. And we all know that Watergate was in part directly connected to the Nixon Agnew reelection campaign of 1972. So we've got a whole bunch of stuff tying in there. Now, we're going to go on to another person who plays a rather interesting role in this whole thing and who himself ties back to that self-same New Orleans office that Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a supposedly pro-Castro organization, shared with Guy Bannister's detective firm, which was a front for anti-Castro activity and right-wing shenanigans of all shapes and sorts.
And this group was fingered by Jim Garrison, and we're going to talk about that in a second. Now, the fellow you're going to hear about was one of three witnesses who Garrison tried to have extradited and was not able to have extradited. And probably best maybe to fill in some of the context so you understand who this guy is in connection with the JFK
assassination. And the Gordon Novell extradition attempt is such a screamer. Even though we mentioned it before, it should be mentioned again. It's so funny.
This is, again, the characteristic legal somersaulting which takes place in connection with the Kennedy assassination. Is one of the many, many strange aspects to this case. Now, basically, a fellow by the name of David Ferry and a number of other CIA-affiliated right-wingers were associated with a guy named Guy Bannister. And Guy Bannister had been head of the Chicago's FBI office, ran what masqueraded as a detective agency and, in effect, was a far right-wing paramilitary front in New Orleans. Bannister was a racist, published something called the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, maintaining that integration was part of a communist conspiracy. Now, his detective office shared a second floor. It was a second floor walk-up, and Bannister's detective agency had the address 531 Lafayette Place. Lee Harvey Oswald, the sole member of the New Orleans chapter of Fair Play for Cuba, had 544 Camp Street, but if you walk up each flight of stairs, you get to the same room, okay? Now, Garrison, basically, without going into all of his investigation, he sought to convict a man. He indicted a man named Clay Shaw for the assassination of President Kennedy, and he tried to have a number of different people extradited, either as co-conspirators or as witnesses. Now, one of the reasons that Garrison's case, one of the reasons it fell through, was the fact that three of the key people he sought to have extradited were not extradited, and the jury found that there had, in fact, been a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. They could not find that Clay Shaw, beyond a reasonable shadow of doubt, that he had been involved in the conspiracy. They decided that they proved that there had been a conspiracy, could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw had been involved. But basically, Garrison's case was deep-sixed by the lack of extradition of three witnesses. First of all, a guy named Sergio Arcacha Smith, another anti-Castro Cuban, Garrison filed an extradition request to Texas to have him extradited from Texas. Then Texas Governor John Connally refused to grant that extradition request, and he crops up in a number of different contexts, including Watergate. He was indicted in the milk scandal connected with Watergate. We'll talk about all that in the phone-in section if you like. Now, the second witness was a guy named Edgar Eugene Bradley. He was stopped by a Dallas policeman named Roger Craig, and Oswald Double was stopped by a Dallas policeman named Roger Craig. An individual came up and identified himself incorrectly, as it turned out later, as a Secret Service agent, and this Oswald Double was then let go by Roger Craig. Now, the fellow who identified himself as a Secret Service agent was identified from photographs by Roger Craig as a guy named Edgar Eugene Bradley, a right-wing affiliated with Reverend Carl McIntyre, a right-wing evangelist who gained a lot of note in the 60s. Now, Edgar Eugene Bradley lived in California, so Garrison filed an extradition request to have Bradley extradited to New Orleans, and then Deputy State Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien, Deputy Attorney General for California, he reviewed the extradition request, recommended that it be granted. Now, then Governor Ronald Reagan turned this whole affair over to his legal counselor, Edwin Meese, who was not only a colonel in Army Intelligence, in the Army Reserve affiliated with intelligence, but also was not only Governor Reagan's legal advisor, he's now President Reagan's White House counselor. Okay, and Meese handled the day-to-day goings-on with regard to the Edgar Eugene Bradley affair. Reagan did not act upon the extradition request until after Richard Nixon had been elected president, and then turned down the request without comment. Now, the third of the third of the people that Garrison tried to have extradited and was unable to do so was a guy named Gordon Novell, last name N-O-V-E-L. Now, Novell was affiliated with the same anti-Castro, CIA-sponsored right-wing milieu in New Orleans in the South that we've been talking about. Now, he also was affiliated with Bannister's, quote, detective agency, unquote. And Novell had deposed to Garrison in connection with an arms theft case connected with Bay of Pigs that a whole bunch of munitions taken from the Schlumberger Company, intended for use by the Bay of Pigs Brigade against Castro, had been stored overnight in Guy Bannister's detective agency. Again, this second floor walk-up with two addresses, one to right-wing Guy Bannister, one to left-wing, alleged left-winger Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, Garrison wanted to question Gordon Novell in connection with the Kennedy case. Novell split for Ohio, and Garrison filed an extradition request to then-Governor of Ohio John Rhodes. Is it John Rhodes? I know there was a minority. The minority leader was John Rhodes from Arizona, and it was Governor Rhodes of Ohio.
I believe it's Governor John Rhodes.
Rhodes. Anyway, Governor Rhodes, first name we may be wrong on, but Governor Rhodes of Ohio, and I think it's John Rhodes. Basically, He agreed to extradite Gordon Novell on the condition that Jim Garrison would not question him about the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, this is absurd, of course, because that was the very thing that Garrison was extradited, attempting to have Novell extradited in order to question him in connection with. So the governor of Ohio says, yeah, we'll grant the extradition request if you don't question him about the thing you want to question him about. And so that's who this fellow Gordon Novell is now. Pick up on his connections to Watergate.
That's right. That slays me. No pun intended. Okay, this little section we're reading here is from a book called Coincidence or Conspiracy, produced by the Committee to Investigate Assassinations under the direction of Bernard Fensterwald, Jr., coincidentally enough, James McCord's lawyer at a later point, and compiled by Michael Ewing. This particular book is published by Zebra Books, Kensington Publishing Corporation. It's copyright 1977. We're going to start out talking about Charles Colson, but Gordon Novell will crop up very quickly. Charles Colson, President Nixon's special counsel and widely hated hatchet man from 1969 to 1973, was the man who originally selected E. Howard Hunt to set up the secret White House plumbers. Colson, with a single exception of H.R. Haldeman, seems to have been involved in more of the horrors of the Nixon Rogues Gallery than any other aide. During his years with Nixon, Colson attained a well-deserved reputation as one of the meanest, most slippery and dangerous men ever to serve in American government. Nixon himself had once remarked, quote, Colson would do anything. Colson had once been involved with one of Jim Garrison's former, quote, suspects in a mysterious plan to erase the Nixon Watergate tapes in March of 1974. This strange information first came to the surface in August of 1974, when Jack Anderson disclosed that Colson had met with New Orleans electronics specialist Gordon Novell in March 1974 and had begun developing plans for the magnetic erasure of various Nixon tapes. Novell, who had received national attention in 1967 as District Attorney Garrison's, quote, missing witness, when he was under investigation for his reported contacts with both David Ferry and Clay Shaw. Novell and Colson discussed the use of an experimental degaussing machine, which could project a magnetic beam into the Nixon tapes and erase them without having to handle them in any way. Anderson reported that Colson had described some of the tapes as containing conversations that, quote, could cause the president's grief, and that Novell recalled that Colson had also spoken of using the erasing machine to obliterate some secret recordings maintained by the CIA as well. Following his discussion with Colson in March of 1974, Gordon Novell flew to Texas to see an associate and drew up a blueprint for the erasing plan, which he cryptically referred to as, quote, the El Paso matter, when he later sent the blueprint to Colson by hand courier in Washington. Colson claimed that the whole erasing idea was just, quote, a joke, and that he had discussed the plan only for, quote, a little bit of comic relief. Okay, well, without confusing you by trying to give you too much more on the Watergate thing itself, just bear that in mind. Here's Gordon Novell, a former Jim Garrison extradition request denied by John Rhodes unless they would agree not to talk to him about the very thing they wanted to extradite him for. Gordon Novell crops up in Watergate trying to help Charles Colson, allegedly trying to help Charles Colson erase the Watergate tapes. Colson, on the other hand, turns around and calls it, quote-unquote, a joke. Okay? Now, this next two little bits here real quickly. This is something we ran across just a couple of years ago with help from Mae Brussel, who found this for us, and we used it on One Step Beyond, and we're going to repeat it here. This is from Technology Illustrated magazine, and it's the April 1983 edition. Okay? And this first little bit is just a little introduction to an article. And it's written by, you know, somebody on the staff, and they're just introducing the article, and they say, last summer for spy tech, and this is meaning like summer of 82, so this is pretty recent. Last summer, four spy tech luminaries gathered at a private 60-acre camp in Powder Springs, Georgia. Mitch Werbel, the host, known in military circles as, quote, the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons, Gordon Novell, a New Orleans entrepreneur and reputed offshore arms merchant, sometimes referred to as the Mad Bomber, Gordon Liddy, star of Watergate and his own autobiography, Will, and Lieutenant Colonel Alan Bell, U.S. Army, retired, one of the world's acknowledged experts in the field of electronic spycraft. Okay, now, that's just the intro that they use, mentioning Gordon Novell as being present with Liddy at Mitch Werbell's ranch, and Mitch Werbell's camp, actually, is what it is, and calling him and mentioning that he's sometimes known as the Mad Bomber. Now, interestingly enough here, in the Technology Illustrated for July of 1983, Mr. Novell takes pen in hand or typewriter in hand to write an article, to write a letter in himself. In the midst of his letter, where he is talking about different things, he says, quote, the only people, this is Gordon Novell himself, by the way, writing in response to that introduction in the article. He says, quote, the only people who have ever had the fortitudinal stupidity to call me, quote, the Mad Bomber, are all now defendants in two ongoing federal civil suits totaling well over $2 billion in damages. This one-man war resulted mainly from my ultra-high technology counterintelligence role in Watergate to erase the White House tapes. Okay, so here's Charles Colson on one hand talking about his contact with this ex-Garrison extradition request as being comic relief and a joke and basically saying it didn't happen. Here's Gordon Novell turning around in a letter to Technology Illustrated basically bragging about his high-tech role in Watergate.
Okay, now the Watergate tapes themselves and some of the controversy surrounding them might be worth covering at this point for those of you who may be scratching your heads and wondering just what this is all about. It was revealed during the course of the public White House, public Watergate hearings by a fellow by the name of Alexander Butterfield that Nixon's White House had a taping system set up and that basically all conversations in the Oval Office had been taped. Now, these tapes were then requested by the special prosecutor set up by joint agreement between the President and Congress to prosecute any crimes connected with Watergate. Of course, these tapes became possible evidence and were subpoenaed as a result. Now, a number of the tapes turned up with very suspicious gaps. One in particular had a very famous 18-and-a-half-minute gap in the middle of it, which remains a source of controversy. So here we have Gordon Novell talking about erasing the Watergate tapes. Many of the tapes themselves have, to this day, unexplained gaps. And indeed, the gaps themselves have some interesting Kennedy-related connections. Nixon's secretary, a woman named Rosemary Woods, was one of the primary suspects in connection with the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. And facing possible prosecution, she retained a man named Charles Rhine, R-H-Y-N-E, who was a legal observer to the Warren Commission and also a close personal friend of Richard Nixon. A lot of other Watergate connections we're going to go into. The GOP counsel, the minority counsel, was a guy named Albert Jenner, and he had been a Warren Commission counsel. So the Kennedy connection, there are many minor ones. We're going to go into some of the major ones here in just a second.
Okay, one of the other things that needs to be mentioned in context of the Nixon tapes is that one of the things that Richard Nixon at one point was, I believe, and I don't remember the exact person he was arguing with or he was talking to, but it was one of his aides, Richard Nixon, and this is in the transcripts once once this came out, and you can find it, I believe, in places, in a variety of places, but Richard Nixon said, literally, one of the reasons that the tapes should not be revealed because they were going to bring up this whole, and I quote Richard Nixon, this whole Bay of Pigs thing. Now, in and of itself, that is very interesting because, according to popular theory, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, embarrassing as it might have been for America, was all known. The Bay of Pigs invasion was started and it failed. Well, one has to ask a series of questions about why Richard Nixon would be so worried, and he was worried, as the conversation showed, about this whole Bay of Pigs thing. And we've talked in the past about his role in planning the Bay of Pigs, which was also pretty well known. But we've also mentioned two possibilities. One is the fact of the CIA scotching their own Bay of Pigs, and the other is the possibility that the scotching of the Bay of Pigs led in part to the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Okay, and worth noting, too, that Nixon ran against Kennedy in 1960, and the Bay of Pigs was one of Kennedy's main embarrassments, and here's Nixon trying to cover the thing up. Talking about also about the tape gaps, too, at one point Nixon, and his reference to the whole Bay of Pigs thing, at one point Nixon was considering, in fact, asked former Warren Commission Chief Counsel J. Lee Rankin to go over the tapes to help edit out national security-related matter. Rankin declined, by the way. So, again, the same cast of characters crops up Now, last week when we were talking about the evidentiary aspects of the Kennedy case, we talked about something called the single bullet theory in a nutshell. And I mean in a nutshell, what this provides for is that a single bullet caused all seven non-fatal wounds in President Kennedy and Governor Connally. There were three shots. One blew Kennedy's head clean off, one missed completely, which leaves a third shot, and that one alone to account for seven non-fatal wounds. If more than one shot is required to cause those wounds, the whole Warren Commission thesis goes down the tubes. Now, one of the things we looked at last week was the fact that something called neutron activation analysis had been performed upon the bullet fragments found in the Kennedy limousine. Now, under that test, basically, the fragments are bombarded with neutrons. They give off a spectrum which reveals the exact molecular structure of the substance. And this is a tremendous breakthrough in regard to forensic science, because this enables determination to be made about bullets and ballistics that had previously totally eluded would-be investigators. Now, as we saw last week, the neutron activation analysis performed on the bullet fragments disproved the single bullet theory, which was physically impossible in a number of respects, but some of the bullet fragments which were found in the car were proved not to have come from CE-399, and this totally disproves the single bullet thesis. Now, one of the most noteworthy authorities on the Kennedy assassination, one of the sort of main men of the research, so to speak, is a fellow by the name of Harold Weisberg, last name Weisberg. We referred to some of his work last week. Harold Weisberg is a former FBI agent who's authored a number of different books on the Kennedy assassination. His most famous series is called Whitewash, and there are four volumes, volumes 1 through 4. Also wrote an excellent but very rare book called Oswald in New Orleans. Now, in 1970, Harold Weisberg and his attorney, a man named Jim Lazar, filed a Freedom of Information Act suit to oblige the Department of Justice and FBI to release the results of the spectrographic analysis of the JFK bullet fragments.
Something, again, should be mentioned just to bring you back up to the present. We are now talking about the Richard Nixon presidency's Justice Department that they were applying to for permission to get this spectro evidence released.
Exactly. And this is 1970. Now, this is 7 years after supposedly Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Freedom of Information Act specifically forbade the withholding of all information, of any information, because of national security or because of national interest. That was not regarded as one of the reasons why a given federal department could withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit. Now, what we've looked at in the past, we're going to look at some of the amazing legal maneuvering that took place in connection with one or another aspect of the Kennedy assassination case. Now, it's worth noting here that, first of all, as everybody learned in high school, our government has three branches. There's the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. All right, Congress is legislative, president is executive, and the Supreme Court and courts are the judicial. Now, the Warren Commission was a presidential fact-finding commission. As such, it was part of the executive branch of the government. It was not part of the judicial branch. As a result, the Warren Commission had absolutely no legal status whatsoever. Keep this in mind, because some very, very strange things are going to occur. Now, when Jim Lazar, Harold Weisberg's attorney, filed a Freedom of Information Act suit, they received a number of different rebuffs from the Justice Department. Now, the only legal grounds upon which the Justice Department can withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit as if it pertains to an ongoing investigation and could in some way damage that or corrupt that. Now, of course, the official version with regard to the assassination of President Kennedy was that Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut, unaided, killed President Kennedy, and since he himself was then executed by the second lone nut, so to speak, Jack Ruby, all possible legal action in the case officially came to an end as of 11/24/63 with the death of Lee Harvey Oswald. So there was no ongoing legal action being pursued by the Justice Department, at least that we know of, and ongoing legal action is the only conceivable grounds that the Justice Department can use to withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit. Now, keep in mind that the FBI's spectrographic analyses were performed for the Warren Commission, which is not even part of the judicial branch of our government. It's part of the executive branch. Now, keep these things in mind because we're going to see some very, very strange things occurring here. Now, I'm going to read you a couple of excerpts here from one of Harold Weisberg and Jim Lazar's books. It's called Whitewash Volume 4. Okay? And the possible legal grounds for the Justice Department withholding evidence from the Freedom of Information Act suit is described here by Jim Lazar, writing in an appendix to Whitewash Volume 4. There was only one conceivable legal justification which the Department of Justice could invoke, its old favorite, the exemption for, quote, investigatory files compiled for law enforcement purposes, unquote. But the purpose of the investigatory file exemption was to prevent premature discovery which, quote, could harm the government's case in court, unquote.